no mergers at all. So Sanjay and I will be on this until they decide to inject some humanity into the process by which they choose to close schools and engage with our community about these choices.
And what's your assessment of the political leadership of Oakland in the face of this? Are they 100% behind this, or can they be moved to pressure the school board?
They can be moved. I mean, I think anyone can be moved. We're humans at the end of the day, you know. It's been laughable, their approach so far. They have not come out to see us. Gavin Newsom hasn't come out to see us, and we've demanded that many times over. We've asked Tony Thurman to come out. We've asked the board to come and speak with us. And the mayor has come out and said, yes, they deserve to close these schools, Mayor Libby Schaaf, and has yet to actually provide proper reasoning. We have no numbers. Anyone looking at these numbers will kind of laugh at it. So leadership in Oakland, in the state of California, have been laughable so far. But we, you know, have open hearts and love and desire to meet and sit with them and break bread with them, ideally someday, and talk about the reasons why our communities need to stay open.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, and we'll report tomorrow on what happens in the school board vote tonight, which I believe is 6 o'clock Pacific time, 9 o'clock our time on the East Coast. Moses Omolade is a community schools manager at Westlake Middle School, part of a group of educators on hunger strike protesting the Oakland Unified School District's proposal to close or merge over a dozen schools. This is day 8 of the strike. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
On this Friday, Moving On will be presenting part one of a program honoring Black History Month. You will hear folk artists including Odetta, Paul Robeson, Rhiannon Giddens, Leadbelly, Sweet Honey and the Rock, and many others. Moving On starts right after the noon news to 1:30. Tune in this Friday to celebrate Black History in Song. Part two will air Friday, February 25th, right after the noon news, only on KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Oregon is among states planning to lift their indoor mask mandate in the coming weeks. The Oregon Secretary of State's office will audit the state's rental assistance program. And the City of Portland and the Portland Police Association have reached a tentative agreement on a new contract. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 8th, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Mayor Ted Wheeler announced Tuesday that the City of Portland and the Portland Police Association have tentatively agreed on a new 4-year contract. The agreement includes a new discipline guide, continued expansion of the Portland Street Response Program, increased pay for required crisis intervention training, retention bonuses, wage bumps for higher education degrees, and cost of living adjustments. The contract does not include a requirement that officers wear body cameras, which is still under discussion. The Portland Police Bureau is currently the largest police department in the country that does not use body cameras. The new contract will last through June of 2025. It still needs to be approved by the City Council and a majority of the members of the Police Association, which represents 881 officers, detectives, sergeants, and forensic criminalists. Under the contract, PPA members will receive a retroactive 1.6% cost of living adjustment, as well as ongoing cost of living adjustments anticipated to be between 1 and 5%. The contract also includes a new guide governing police discipline, or a so-called corrective action guide, that recommends education-based remedies for policy violations and categories of offenses. In addition, the contract allows for the expansion of the Portland Street Response Program, which dispatches a mental health worker and fire paramedic to crisis calls. According to the announcement, there will be several opportunities for Portlanders to learn more and weigh in on the contract, including a virtual education session on February 10th with lead negotiator Stephen Schuback and Chief Deputy City Attorney Heidi Brown, as well as a City Council hearing on February 16th with public testimony, and a final Council vote on February 24th. The Oregon Health Authority reported 8,000 more COVID-19 cases over the weekend. Since the beginning of the pandemic, more than 662,000 people in Oregon have been infected with COVID-19. In Monday's report, OHA also reported another 30 COVID-19-related deaths. The state's death toll now stands at 6,244 people. There are currently 1,072 people hospitalized statewide, including 197 patients in intensive care units. Only 66 ICU beds are still available across the entire state, while just 8% of adult non-ICU beds are currently available. So far, more than 3.1 million people in Oregon have had at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, while over 2.8 million have completed their vaccination series. Oregon health officials announced Monday that the state will lift its indoor mask mandate no later than March 31st. The decision comes as health officials expect to see a significant decrease in the number of Oregonians hospitalized with COVID-19. They believe that by late March, 400 or fewer people in the state will be hospitalized due to the virus. OHA said state health officials would consider lifting the general indoor mask mandate earlier than March 31st if hospitalizations decline to the levels projected by the end of March sooner than expected. Mask requirements for schools will be lifted on March 31st. The mask mandate will remain in place for healthcare settings. Businesses and employers can establish their own mask requirements after the state rules are lifted. In addition, health experts strongly recommend people continue to wear masks even after the requirements are lifted if they are unvaccinated, immunocompromised, at high risk of COVID-19 hospitalization, or living with other people at high risk. Governors in four states, including Oregon, have announced plans to lift statewide mask requirements in schools in the next few weeks. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Governors in four states announced plans yesterday to lift statewide mask requirements in schools by the end of February or March. Oregon is one of the four, with the list also including Connecticut, Delaware, and New Jersey. 12 states still have active school mask mandates. Some, like California, will end indoor mask requirements for vaccinated persons, but continue to mandate them for school children. In Illinois, a judge recently struck down the governor's mask mandate, but in the Chicago school system, teachers refused to hold in-person classes until masks were provided to students and staff. There are several reasons for the lifting of the mandates. On one hand, COVID cases have fallen dramatically in 47 states, and so have hospitalizations. Nationwide, new COVID cases have dropped by more than 500,000 from a peak of greater than 800,000 daily. The number of patients hospitalized has fallen 28% since mid-January. On the other hand, there is a growing sense COVID will always be with us and that we have to find some kind of path back to normalcy. Death rates do remain high because there is a delay from time of infection to time of dying. It is possible individual school districts could continue to mandate masking. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A bill in the Oregon legislature could prevent police officers from pulling drivers over for minor infractions. Senate Bill 1510 would also require officers to inform drivers that they can refuse a search when pulled over. If made into law, officers would be prohibited from stopping drivers for a single broken headlight, tail brake light, or license plate light, but can still ticket drivers for those infractions if pulled over for an unsafe driving violation, such as speeding. Officers would be required to receive consent from the driver before completing a search. A 2021 investigation by the New York Times found that over 400 drivers or passengers who were not wielding weapons nor under pursuit of a violent crime were killed by police officers within the last 5 years. The goal of the bill is to decrease interactions with police officers that could result in violence. According to advocacy groups such as the Transforming Justice Coalition and the Next Up Action Fund, people of color are disproportionately affected by unnecessary interactions with police, like traffic stops made for minor infractions. Some law enforcement officials and attorney generals argue that the proposed bill would make Oregon roads less safe. Yamhill County Sheriff Tim Svensson spoke on behalf of the Oregon State Police Officers Association and Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. Svensson noted that the inability to stop cars with broken headlights and taillights would create hazardous conditions for motorists. Other groups expressed hesitation as well. Leaders from the Oregon District Attorneys Association are concerned that the introduction of this bill would be confusing, since the state's search and seizure law has been in flux for the past 5 years. In addition to prohibiting officers from stopping cars for minor infractions, the bill would also reform parole and probation conditions. The Oregon Secretary of State will audit the state's rental assistance program after legislators called for a closer examination. The Oregon Emergency Rental Assistance Program has distributed emergency housing funding to 38,000 households. It has sent out more than $268 million to Oregonians since June. However, the program has struggled to keep up with the number of applicants. The state has yet to pay out funds to another 32,000 households. Applications started moving more quickly after the state hired a contractor to process them and make payments. But some issues have continued, including sending out incomplete checks or mailing them to the wrong landlord. The program also stopped taking applications for 8 weeks, as officials forecasted the federally funded program would expend all of its $289 million. The program reopened in January after lawmakers allocated more state funding in December. Housing agency officials said they expect the portal will remain open for another 3 to 5 weeks, as they distribute about $43 to $60 million to renters who submit new applications. In an email to the state housing agency, Kip Memmott, the director of the Secretary of State's Audits Division, said his office would release an audit plan to the public after briefing legislators this week. Memmott said, quote, "The state is facing criticism for stopping the application process for these funds, even though it has been reported that Oregon was one of the timeliest states issuing rental assistance. Issues cited by legislators and other stakeholders include technical challenges with rental assistance software and public communication challenges." End quote. February is Black History Month. North Dakota students are learning about key figures, events, and aspects of Black culture. While it might not affect those teachings, the state does have a new law that bans the teaching of critical race theory. Education leaders say it isn't helpful in the broader effort to connect with students on these issues. Mike Moen has more on the story.
During Black History Month, North Dakota teachers highlight the work of iconic figures like Martin Luther King Jr. But the state is also one of several now that bans curriculum related to critical race theory, prompting broader concerns among educators. Last fall, North Dakota joined the movement of conservative-led states in banning teaching about the lasting effects of systemic racism. State education officials note it doesn't limit this month's teachings and that standards cover issues like social responses to inequality. Nick Archuleta with the Educator Union North Dakota United has confidence in the standards, but thinks the law isn't necessary.
Everybody should be in favor of teaching the truth about American history. And if that involves teaching some things that doesn't put us in a flattering light, so be it. It's still history and it's still the truth.
Opponents also note the concept of critical race theory was designed for college classrooms. And policy analysts worry the way some laws are written, they could lead to further restrictions on teaching about racism. A spokesperson for North Dakota's Department of Public Instruction says the state's law is straightforward and that districts have freedom to adapt their curriculum. But Archuleta says these laws put more pressure on teachers to make sure they're not violating any new rules when talking about Black History Month or longstanding racial issues. He notes a new survey from the union shows North Dakota teachers are already fed up with politics conflicting with education.
Teachers didn't sign up to become a political football. They came because they have a sincere desire to do what's right by the children in their charge.
In the survey, 53% of the educators who responded said they feel at least some pressure from politicians and parents to teach a certain way to be less controversial. And 3/4 said political discourse would play a role in their decision on whether to leave the profession. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
More Black West Virginians are turning to farming. McDowell County farmer Jason Tart sees his role as both developing economic opportunity through farming and supporting other Black farmers in the region. Nadia Romlagon has more on the story.
West Virginia farmer Jason Tart says the Mountain State is fertile territory for budding farm producers. As a Black farmer, Tart sees his role as both developing economic opportunity through farming and supporting other Black farmers in West Virginia. Also a military veteran, Tart is now growing fruit trees on what was formerly logging land.
I'm working on a project with West Virginia State University to put in an apple orchard. They're going to be grafting and putting in several varieties of apples and try to encourage orcharding in Appalachia again.
Tart says the state has plentiful maple trees, which he sees as an overlooked market in West Virginia. Black farmers are an underrepresented group in the U.S. According to census data, around 35,000 farms are Black-owned. Nationwide, out of more than 2 million. In West Virginia, just 31 farms out of more than 23,000 are Black-owned or operated. Tart says his goal is to build a viable agricultural economy in the region and attract other Black residents to West Virginia, particularly McDowell County.
Rural Appalachia presents enormous opportunities for the Black community, and we just don't see that.
In an effort to attract and develop younger farmers, Tart has also founded a nonprofit called the American Youth Agripreneur Association. McDowell County's population has decreased by more than 20% in the past decade, and only about 8.5% of its residents are Black. This is Nadia Romlagon for West Virginia News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Zach Winston, Policy Director with the Oregon Justice Resource Center, about three bills that were unsuccessful in 2021 that have been reintroduced in the 2022 Oregon Legislature session and their impacts on adults in Oregon prisons. Followed by Noise Filter, debunking the COVID-19 pandemic. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 56 degrees. Today in history, in 1968, police officers in Orangeburg, South Carolina, opened fire on a crowd of young people during a protest against racial segregation, killing 3 young Black men and wounding around 30 other people. The killing sparked outrage across the nation, but the governor of South Carolina blamed so-called Black Power advocates rather than the police. Now known as a massacre, the incident is still commemorated by the university and others in South Carolina. But social commentators have noted that its place in America's collective memory is not as prominent as that of the similar Kent State and Jackson State massacres, both of which occurred during anti-Vietnam War protests and which collectively claimed the lives of 6 white students in 1970. The quote of the day is from American literary critic, professor, and filmmaker Henry Louis Gates Jr., who said, quote, "The first step toward tolerance is respect, and the first step toward respect is knowledge." Another COVID milestone is marked at the Capitol. New redistricting maps are approved for Alabama and rejected in Ohio, and the White House presents a united front on Russia with international leaders. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times. The bells tolled at the National Cathedral to mark a tragic milestone in the pandemic, 900,000 deaths. Later, members of Congress gathered on the steps outside the U.S. Capitol.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a moment of silence and remembrance.
While the surge in cases from Omicron is slowing down, daily deaths still average 2,400. The U.S. Supreme Court reinstated new congressional maps in Alabama that district courts ruled violated the Voting Rights Act. Former Democratic State Senator Myron Penn argues the district lines are drawn based on race.
We have one black congressional member from Alabama, and the other six out of the seven happen to be white. One Democrat, the rest are Republicans. The 7th District in particular, it's 67 or 68% black voters there, which naturally dilutes the black vote in other counties.
It's the first case involving 2020 redistricting to reach the Supreme Court. Also on Monday, the Ohio Supreme Court rejected legislative maps that had been ordered to be redrawn, finding the second set violated the state constitution's prohibitions against partisan gerrymandering and fell short of its proportionality standards. The Ohio Redistricting Commission is now tasked with drawing a third set of maps. The U.S. House is expected to vote today on a new continuing resolution to extend current federal spending levels through March 11th. The government is currently operating on a continuing resolution that expires on February 18th. A bipartisan bill to ban mandatory arbitration in sexual harassment and assault cases brought by workers was passed by the House.
Many such victims, if given the choice, will choose to go to court. And why shouldn't they? In arbitration, they lose 98% of the cases.
That's New York Congressman Jerry Nadler. The bill has been in work since 2017 when the Me Too movement exposed how such clauses can shield abusers from accountability. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki defended the Biden administration for not firing its top science advisor amid reports of bullying.
The president's objective is to prevent this behavior from ever happening again.
Office of Science and Technology Policy Chief Dr. Eric Lander apologized after an internal probe revealed allegations of demeaning behavior towards subordinates. The White House is being criticized for not following Biden's zero-tolerance pledge regarding inappropriate staff conduct. After meeting with representatives from the European Union, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. and its allies are united should Russia's aggression towards Ukraine intensify.
We will see what President Putin decides, but either way, he is going to find a Europe and United States that are fully aligned, fully coordinating, fully cooperative.
President Joe Biden echoed the sentiments after talks with Germany's chancellor and urged Americans to leave Ukraine. The White House says Russia has amassed 70% of the troops needed to launch a full-scale invasion. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Leonard Peltier supporters rally for his release. And the Spirit Lake Tribe, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, and individual voters filed a lawsuit Monday challenging North Dakota's new legislative map, claiming it dilutes the voting rights of Native Americans. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Leonard Peltier supporters rallied for his release in a handful of cities across the country Monday. They say he's at risk after getting COVID-19 in prison. Ariel Zients of South Dakota Public Broadcasting reports from Rapid City.
Protesters marched through downtown and rallied in front of the federal courthouse to demand the release of Leonard Peltier. Rapid City is near the Pine Ridge Reservation, where FBI agents got in a shootout with members of the American Indian Movement in 1975. Peltier is serving two life sentences after being convicted of murdering agents Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams. Peltier has admitted to participating in the shooting, but says he didn't kill the agents. Supporters accuse the FBI and prosecutors of coercing witnesses and withholding evidence. The 77-year-old recently contracted COVID and has medical conditions that make him at risk of complications. Supporters want Peltier released under a home confinement program for high-risk inmates like himself. They're also calling on President Joe Biden to grant clemency. LaVon Roach says she relates to Peltier since she also had COVID in prison. The Rapid City woman served 23 years behind bars before President Donald Trump granted her clemency.
The medical care in federal prisons is the worst you'll ever experience. I almost died two times in federal prison.
Supporters say Peltier got COVID-19 after being denied a booster shot. And they say he hasn't been able to speak with his lawyer since January 29th. Every federal prison went into lockdown that day due to a deadly riot in Texas. The Bureau of Prisons says it's providing boosters, and it says it makes attorneys available during lockdowns on a case-by-case basis. The agency did not answer questions about Peltier. For National Native News, I'm Ariel Zients.
A city in Minnesota is planning to rename a park and may pay select Native people for their input. The Pioneer Press reports the city of Roseville wants to rename Pocahontas Park. The Parks and Recreation Commission has been considering the change since a youth commissioner suggested it in 2020. Commissioners told the city council Monday a majority of comments from the public favor the change, pointing to inaccurate and stereotypical imagery often associated with Pocahontas. The commission is considering a stipend for Native Americans to take part in the renaming process. Some commissioners say the payment is no different than paying consultants for guidance. No dollar amount or time frame has been set for the renaming process. The Spirit Lake Tribe, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, and individual voters filed a lawsuit Monday in U.S. District Court for the District of North Dakota. They're challenging North Dakota's new legislative map. They say redistricting has split up Turtle Mountain citizens into two sub-districts and Spirit Lake in one district. Tribal leaders had asked for the two tribes to be drawn into the same district. Plaintiffs say they're limited in electing state legislative seats. The lawsuit alleges violation of the Voting Rights Act. The Native American Rights Fund is among law groups representing the plaintiffs. Fort Lewis College and the University of Colorado College of Nursing announced a new partnership Monday. They're teaming up on a four-year undergraduate degree in nursing, bringing the Medical Institute to Fort Lewis, which serves rural and indigenous students in southwest Colorado. The first cohort is expected to begin in the fall of 2023. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A free online tool can identify climate risks in your neighborhood. Neighborhoods at Risk helps you learn about potential flooding, heat waves, and other threats to your community. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Heat waves and storms, floods and fires. Climate change will affect all communities, but in diverse ways. To help people understand what's expected where they live, the nonprofit research group Headwaters Economics created a free online tool called Neighborhoods at Risk.
It identifies vulnerabilities in every single community and county in the United States.
Patty Hernandez is Headwaters Executive Director. She says people can use the tool to learn about flooding vulnerability, extreme heat, and other climate risks for their town or neighborhood. It also provides racial and socioeconomic data. For example, the percentage of people in an area who live in poverty, lack health insurance, or are elderly. She says this information can help decision makers create plans to protect those who are most vulnerable during climate disasters or may have the hardest time recovering afterward.
We're very aware that too often climate resilience programs fail to help rural and low-income communities and communities of color. And we have the opportunity to invest in communities and neighborhoods that are being left behind.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 8th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Caitlin Backus and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Nadia Romlagon, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM,
and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kovanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, covering art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Dirtbag. Host Glenn Anderson and guest Jim Gilbert compare pruning kiwis and grapevines, plus an appreciation of the Japanese flowering plum. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with Zach Winston, Policy Director with the Oregon Justice Resource Center.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The 2022 Oregon Legislative Session convened on February 1st. The Oregon Justice Resource Center will reintroduce three bills that were unsuccessful in the 2021 legislative session. With me is Zach Winston, Policy Director with Oregon Justice Resource Center. Zach, talk about the three bills you'll be reintroducing in Salem.
So we have three bills, as you mentioned. The first is the Oregon Justice for Exonerees Act, which is Senate Bill 1584. Last session, it was SB 499, so Senate Bill 499. And just a quick overview is it provides exonerees access to the court to address harm caused by the state and to be compensated for that harm for their years wrongfully incarcerated and on supervision. The second bill is Restoration of Voting Rights